It's Learning to Listen with Quinn, Naomi, and Charlie.
Yay!
Welcome, L2L, the podcast. How the hell are you guys doing? It's one of those Rolling Stones greatest albums of all time episodes. Today we're going to be talking all about Dusty Springfield's Dusty in Memphis. That's right. You have stumbled on, or, you know, signed into on purpose, downloaded even maybe. You're listening to L2L, Learning to Listen. This is where we're talking about music and the way we listen to music. We're trying to engage with the music we listen to. We are all about the lost art of engaged listening. So that's why we're talking about albums and consuming the album as a whole. Artistic statement. The way artists intended. I gave that one Garth Brooks. This isn't a biography show. Instead, it is a pure guttural and visceral reaction to the music we are listening to. So my name is Quinn. I am your host. I have co-hosts with me. As always, there is Charlie Scream on the drops.
Charlie Scream.
Somebody's hard drive isn't working today, but there may be a real drop here. We'll maybe, maybe not. Depends on how much he feels like editing.
I think it's better without.
And then, of course, you know, you might find her on sniffer.com someday soon. Naomi Carmack.
Buy my panties on the interwebs.
That's right. If you guys want to know all about that, you're going to have to go to patreon.com/learningtolisten. You know, we fire up the microphones a little early and we get chatting, and chat usually goes in a slightly different direction than this podcast that you're hearing now goes, but only the Patreons know that. So patreon.com/learningtolisten to get in on that conversation. Okay, we are doing Rolling Stones 100 greatest albums of all time according to their top 500 list from 2012, amended in 2020. So today's album is going to be Dusty in Memphis by Dusty Springfield. You guys want to hear a little synopsis of the record?
Tell us about it.
Sure. I believe this is number 83 on our list.
Yep.
Dusty in Memphis is the fifth studio album by English singer Dusty Springfield. Initial sessions were recorded at American Sound Studios in Memphis, while Springfield's final vocals and the album's orchestral parts were recorded at Atlantic Records' New York City Sounds. The album was released on the 18th of January, 1969 in the United States by Atlantic Records, and Philips Records distributed the record outside the U.S. Springfield worked on the album with a team of musicians and producers that included Jerry Wexler, R.F. Martin, Tom Dowd, conductor Gene Orloff, backing vocalist The Sweet Inspirations, bassist Tommy Cogbill, and guitarist Reggie Young. Just a little extra note here, Dusty in Memphis sold poorly upon its initial release, despite featuring one of Springfield's top 10 UK hits, Son of a Preacher Man. It has since been generally acclaimed as her best work and one of the greatest albums of all time. So, there you go. Number 83 on our list, or on Rolling Stones' list, I should say.
But, on their list.
But in this series, that's the position it falls in. So, guys, let's get this conversation started. Dusty Springfield, I'm assuming you guys know the name. Mm-hmm. I've heard a few songs. How familiar are you guys with Dusty?
I only heard Son of a Preacher Man.
Only ever? You've never heard like The Look of Love?
That's what I thought. But then I'm looking through the song titles here of her other hits, and these are songs I've heard of before, definitely. But I don't know if I've heard her doing them or other versions.
Well, that's a good point. There are definitely a lot of versions of even her biggest hit songs out there.
I Only Want to Be With You, or You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. I know that song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Charlie, what about you? You a Dusty aficionado?
Or? Well, I'm not an aficionado, but I've definitely heard some stuff. I mean, of course, you know, Preacher Man for sure, but also some, I'm sure I've heard some other things. I feel like this is the easiest listeningest album we've ever done on this show, isn't it?
I'd say so.
Like I said, in it. Like you're British all of a sudden. He doesn't listen to some Dusty Springfield. And you're like, this is easy listening. How about you have listened to
in down it? Of the pub, have a pint in it.
In it. All right. So what you're saying though is that you've never listened to this record.
Not this album full.
Yeah, myself neither. I've obviously aware of Dusty Springfield. I think the first time I can say I heard Son of a Preacher Man is probably in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that's where it was, yeah. Right? Quentin.
By our ages, yeah, I would say that makes sense.
Yeah, Quentin Tarantino used it for sure. I was actually trying to think. I'm like, I can't remember where in Pulp Fiction it is, but I think I just remember hearing it maybe on the soundtrack or something. But I definitely associated it with
it was
Pulp Fiction with sure. With Quentin and his brand of movie mayhem. But yeah, definitely had never sat down and listened to this record before. All the Dusty I've heard is, you know, the singles, the hits. People are requesting to sing the song at karaoke quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I was really surprised to find out that this song wasn't necessarily a big hit in the US. I'm not sure where it charted, but it was top 10 in the UK. So bigger over in the UK than it was here, but kind of makes sense. Atlantic was a label that signed a lot of British artists. As a little point of trivia, Dusty is also who talked Jerry Wexler into signing Led Zeppelin.
Oh, yeah.
Because she had worked with bassist John Paul Jones in one of her previous... He had backed her up, or she had done some backup vocals in a band with him or something like that. They were acquainted.
Nice. I can tell you that U.S., the Son of a Preacher Man charted only... It peaked at number 10 in the U.S. Billboard.
Okay, so it hit number 10.
It hit number 10, but that's it.
Well, okay, interesting. So, Charlie, you were already kind of hinting away at how you felt about it, that you were like, this is the easiest listeningest album.
I think it's the easiest listeningest album we've done.
Out of our list so far, you might be right. It's definitely... I can't think of anything else that's easy, that would fall into easy listening. I didn't think easy listening when I heard it, though, but I do get what you're saying.
Well, I mean, at the time when it came out, it would have just been a pop album, right? And it's still a pop album.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, it's very, in some ways, it's very of its time. In other ways, it's kind of timeless, you know?
Right.
There's it's classic. You can definitely say that about it. It's interesting to me that it didn't do that well initially, that it's more in some kind of retrospect that people have come around to it. And maybe that's because of Son of a Preacher Man. Maybe, like, I know that it charted again in the 90s because of being included in Pulp Fiction or whatever, or maybe people back then kind of looked at it again. And
Tarantino's got that touch, right? He could do it with actors. He could do it with songs.
Yeah, he revived John Travolta's career when he was doing Talking Baby movies. So.
John Travolta, Little Green Bag. You know, he can do. He just picks and chooses what he likes.
Steelers wheels.
Steelers wheel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Well, okay. If there's anything you can say about Quentin Tarantino, he's got taste.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you might not agree with his taste, but he's got some of
He's got taste. It's a very specific taste.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Naomi, what was your impression going into this record like?
I have to agree with the whole, like, it was easy to digest. Like, I felt comfortable and relaxed listening to it. It wasn't making me like pull my hair out. It was really nice. But another thing I realized too is with the only song I really remember being Son of a Preacher Man, her vocal in that song is very basic. There's nothing really to it. Now, when I listen to her sing all these other songs, I was like, damn, this girl can sing.
Mm.
But instead of a preacher man, she doesn't really show what she's capable of doing.
I would say that, Son of a Preacher Man. So this album is...
She's almost talk singing on the
Son of a Preacher Man. Yeah. She's going for like a kind of like a down south sort of, like, you know, the influence here is obviously having worked in Memphis, American Sound Studios. Jerry Wexler famously, producer at Atlantic, he loved taking his New York, his, you know, musicians down to like Muscle Shoals, down to Memphis. He worked with Aretha Franklin and got her first big hits by taking her down to Muscle Shoals and working with the Wrecking Crew, that sort of thing. He knew that he could get certain elements of this soul vibe out of artists who are otherwise a little too cosmopolitan for their own good.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, interesting enough, I was thinking about it, and I had just watched the Aretha Franklin biopic that came out last year, not too long ago. Mark Maron actually plays Jerry Wexler.
Nice.
It's an interesting biopic. It's definitely one of those play the hits biopics.
Sure.
Right. But as far as like a look into somebody's life who I really didn't know that much about, it's pretty interesting. But the most interesting part to me is when she does get to Atlantic and she starts working with, the Wrecking Crew guys and Jerry Wexler and stuff. And I'm like, oh, this is amazing. They're recreating these moments in the studio. And of course it's Hollywood. It's condensing like the way they write a song in the studio just by being like, they just magically jam it out in like one go and that's the take, that sort of thing. I'm like, God, could you imagine if that actually happened that way? Which is anyway.
What are you talking about?
but this is the Jerry Wexler magic. And I think this is maybe, I don't know if this is the first or second album he did with her, but he's basically giving Dusty the Aretha Franklin treatment here. And they were kind of contemporary. So this would be happening around the same timeline, except instead of Muscle Shoals, he takes her to Memphis. And then I guess it has enough of an effect on her that they're like, yeah, here you go. This whole album is affected by your time hanging out and working with musicians in Memphis. So we're calling the album Dusty in Memphis, 'cause it's got some Memphis sound to it or whatever. But then they still go back to New York to do the vocals and do the orchestra and stuff like that. So it's interesting to think of it in that context, that she did do some guide vocals and takes at American Recording Studios in Memphis, but then overdubbed them in New York anyway.
Well, I heard something about that.
Okay.
I heard that she showed up at the recording studio and there was all these like names of people that she idolized and she thought very highly of. And she's the kind of person who's got like for sure stage fright. And so she couldn't sing she couldn't sing a note. Like they tried, but they got nothing out of her at those takes. So they had to do them separately is what I heard about it.
Well, okay. What I heard too is that she was used to being in a studio setup where it's like, you've got all the players, you've got somebody conducting the strings and the orchestra arrangements while she's in the booth, that sort of thing. And then she found that this was too intimate, that it was, she's like, I wasn't used to recording with just what she called rhythm tracks, right? With just a piano and bass and drummer and guitar player. What I'm wondering is where the backup singers got recorded, if they were recorded in Memphis or if they were recorded in New York.
Well, that would be weird if they got recorded before the main.
It's possible, though, because obviously she must have thrown down some guide vocals, right?
Sure.
They did not record her singing in Memphis. What was the point of going to Memphis if she wasn't going to do some work there, right? But back to your point about Son of a Preacher Man, Naomi, is I would say that the Sweet Inspirations really sell that. Now, Dusty can sing. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And like you were saying, I think some of the other tracks on the album show a lot of the dynamics and range in her voice, where you're right, like she kind of gives it a little bit more of the, there's a, like, I think it's going for a little bit of a slow southern sultriness or whatever, kind of a little slightly talked out, not quite a recitation, but then it's like, it's those backup singers that really elevate those choruses, right? And I would say the handful of tracks that they're on in this album are the best ones. Like they really lend that credibility to that idea of this like Southern soul, vibe that they're going for. But the whole album isn't a solid country soul, down home, down south album.
There's not
French pop nouveau guns and shit like that on here. There's straight up just like cosmopolitan style pop. It's all over the place, really. It's not like a solid, like,
I like that
theme throughout. Yeah, I do too.
I like,
and
then
that got me looking at the songwriters, and it's really interesting to me because I noticed something about the songs that I gravitated towards, and I started seeing a couple of names that I recognize. Like I saw Donnie Fritz. And now you guys might not know who Donnie Fritz is, but he's basically a session musician who, and he'd released a few of his own albums, and they used to call him like Funky Donnie Fritz and stuff like that. He's a piano player. He actually played with Kris Kristofferson for quite a few years, but he put out an album of his own that would fall under the category of a very unknown, very, very subgenre of music that's heavily influenced by some of the stuff that like that like Dusty's doing here, like Son of a Preacher Man. And the song he wrote is called Breakfast in Bed.
Yep.
Which is one of the other songs that even has the same intro guitar lick.
Pretty close, eh?
Yeah. You know that do-do-do-do that starts Son of a Preacher Man? Do-do-do-do. Yeah, you hear almost the a nearly identical guitar lick open Breakfast in Bed, but it's completely different songwriter, just same session musicians are the ones who are interpreting it this way, but it's Donnie Fritz. Anyway, the genre I'm talking about is called country funk. And I anybody who's listening and goes, what the fuck is country funk? I would say, I mean, look it up. There's a few compilations out there. It's basically a kind of a, it's not so much a genre as it is just a bit of a feel or a vibe in music that it kind of lends itself hand in hand with this, like with like a Son of a Preacher Man vibe. Other artists who you would kind of think of in that genre would be like Bobby Gentry, Tony Joe White, and then, you know, Donnie Fritz, like I said, he put in an album. In fact, he has a song called something, or no, the album is not called Something Funky. I don't think there's a song on it called Something Funky Going On. And, you know, and what it is it's like just a few more elements from funk and soul with like that, you know, with that Southern kind of country vibe, like, and if there's anything that this album made me want to do listening to it was go and listen to Bobby Gentry. Lot. Yeah. That was a long way to get the connective tissue of, sure. I'm like, oh man, this just makes me want to like the Son of a Preacher Man is such a Bobby Gentry vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And then she did the following year after this, she recorded her own version of Son of a Preacher Man. And damn, if it's not a little bit grittier, a little bit cooler, it still has quite a lot of the same elements though.
Sure.
It's got the same backup vocals, but yeah, I don't know, man. That my favorite songs on this album were all the songs that I could put kind of in that category, you know, like the other aforementioned Breakfast in Bed.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that would be the other one for sure that I was really drawn to. You know, but I was at first really drawn in by, you know, how solid and smooth the production was. And then initially, like in the first three bars of the first song, and Dusty's vocals come in pretty quick on Just a Little Lovin'. And I'm like, oh man, this is smooth as hell.
That's my favorite on here. I like it.
Yeah.
I listen to the lyrics. The lyrics about the morning sex. Woo.
Yeah, exactly. Just a little love in the morning is better than a cup of coffee. But I was like, damn, you know, this is going in the hot tub.
Like, yeah, for sure. You know,
mix.
This like is the hot, there's a hot tub mix. It's well, not just a whole like yard mix.
There isn't an official hot tub mix, but I'm saying if there is one, you should put it on. If you have a Boner Jams playlist,
Boner
put
Jams?
This on your Boner Jams playlist, right?
Cut.
Put this next to like the Teddy Pendergrasts and I don't know, the Isaac Hayes's and the Neos and
Heat Sweats.
Yeah, the Genuines, right? I'd say R. Kelly. Diamonds. I don't know. Yeah, I don't think.
No,
I think,
R. Kelly.
I think you got to leave R. Kelly off now. Like,
he's out.
It's unfortunate. I wish he didn't, but yeah. No. So this album. Like I wrote that down like three bars in, I'm sold. If I had put this on the turntable, I'm like, oh, okay. I bought a good record. Like I'm going to listen to this record. I know two songs from now is going to be Son of a Preacher Man. And it's a jam. It's a bang.
You're going to be in for a good time there. Yeah.
Yeah. Then it's interesting, man. I keep looking around this, this list of songwriters. And then I come across a little known songwriter at the time. He had written a couple of minor hits for a couple other people. But at the time, you know, he wouldn't have a hit of his own until 1977, so almost a decade after this. A little guy named Randall Stewart Newman.
Yeah, old Randy.
Randy Newman.
Randy yeah. Newman.
And I've got to say, I don't know, it's interesting. Prince. So the song is I Don't Want to Hear It Anymore. And that's a little bit of a play on words because you think, which makes sense for Randy Newman, because you think the title is like, I don't want to hear it from you anymore. But it's like, oh, I don't want to hear people talking about us anymore.
Mm-hmm.
People are talking about us. I don't want to hear it anymore. But that's where then I'm kind of a little bit like, oh, I don't know. Maybe this is like a bit of a slow, easy listening record after all.
Right.
You know, like the fact that it comes right after Son of a Preacher Man, I think it's a little misplaced on the record.
Mm. It was one of the ones that I didn't notice as much, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I definitely noticed Breakfast in Bed and Just a Little Lovin'. And it's interesting that those are your guys' favorite tracks. And I'll tell you this, I don't know how long, I don't know, I don't think it's happened this year yet, but this might just be the first track of the year, one of the tracks on this album that I am absolutely low-key obsessed with now after hearing it. I've listened to it like 10 times already.
Which one is that?
The Windmills of Your Mind.
Oh, interesting.
That song is just so good. And yeah, it's true that I had heard it before, not this version, but way back in the day, a little tiny Charlie Scream remembers the Muppet Show doing that skit. They did that song and they did a fun little thing with it. And then I heard it here and I was like, now I've heard this before, but it was a lot faster and it was different and it was funnier, right? So I looked it up and sure enough, but then just like the writing of that song. And I think that's one of the ones where you're talking about it being like French kind of pop.
Yeah, that pop like nouveau.
Yeah, that's definitely what it is. So I became obsessed with that song. I listened to it a whole bunch of times over and over. And then I went and I wanted to find, I just feel like there's got to be a good heavier version, like a newer, rockier version of it.
Well, there's a Sting version I know that came out in the 90s.
I didn't hear the Sting version, but I don't think that's what I want out of it.
That's probably not what you were looking for.
The closest thing, like it feels like it should be more of a jam. Like, you know, like slowly picking up speed kind of a song. Uh-huh. But yeah, it's just, I didn't hear exactly what I wanted out of it from other covers or... This is a great version of the song, but I feel like it's just a little too slow. Like the pace could have been upped a little bit and it would have been a real good jam. But uh-huh. even as it is, I think it's like, I don't know. I just, that took over the whole album for me. I was like, okay, this song right here.
Okay. It definitely did not affect me that way. I found that I was definitely leaning into more of the Southern soul.
Mm-hmm.
elements of this album than the it lost me a little sometimes with the pop nouveau, but now I haven't looked this up and I'm gonna look it up right now. Did the song The Look of Love come out before this album or after this album?
I have no idea.
I think before, but I'm not really sure on that. That's another song that I did know.
Okay, I think it came out before. Yes, okay. So it came out in 67. So that was probably her bigger hit. It's a Burt Bacharach song, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly, right? Which you can totally tell. Like, man, there's a thing going on in the 60s in like what would have been kind of contemporary pop, you know, like more... Like, this is not psychedelic. This isn't, you know, this isn't necessarily, this isn't for the kids buying 45s or whatever. Although I think that's probably what happened with Preacher Man is that the people who liked that song.
Right.
You know, it'd be the equivalent of nowadays, like, you know, getting your 99-cent song, or I guess not even like 10 years ago. Like, I'm really dating myself, maybe even longer, but going to the iTunes store and like just buying the 99 cent like Justin Bieber single or something like that, but not that buying an album. I have a feeling that that's what happened with Son of a Preacher Man. You know, people were like, I really like that song, but no. I put the record on in the record store and
the rest of it,
that's the song I want. So they bought the 45. But yeah, this is that world. Like, you know, you wonder about it, but like, yeah, there was a Burt Bacharach, like, mm-hmm. you know, just these, I guess, the birth of easy listening.
I mean, he's one of the writers on one of the tracks.
Too. And so that makes sense, right? That she had a hit with The Look of Love. It's got that bossa nova thing going on, right? Like there was a little bit of that element of, you know, that French influence or that European influence on the pop music.
Mm-hmm.
That was going on at the time, man. So it makes sense that would also be a vibe. Like they didn't abandon that totally. Right. They still went to that well for the songs.
Yeah.
Right. That they weren't just going, that they weren't just like, let's go whole hog. We're just going to make this a Southern, like, we're just going to make this a Southern country soul record. But, you know, like, I guess it worked, like it worked for you, but there's part of me that's like, man, what if they had committed? What if they had made, like, what if they had made basically a Bobby Gentry record?
Sure. You know? I mean, I'm sure that would have been great too.
I think, you know, Bobby Gentry's voice is a little more genuine, you know, but the thing is, there's no hints of Dusty's voice being from the UK. If I didn't know that, I don't think I would have suspected it.
Hmm. Yeah. Right? You don't hear any sort of accent or anything.
Well, it's not even just the accent, but she sells it. Right.
Right.
You know, like if I had only ever heard Son of a Preacher Man, I might assume that, yeah. Oh yeah. She could have been from somewhere south of the Mason-Dixon line or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I would have bought it if I'd never heard her like speak out loud. Or
that was the only taste of her whole catalog that you had was that. You were like, yeah, okay. So she's from south.
I don't know.
So what?
Like, she sells it, right?
Mm-hmm. It was something I was surprised to read that she was British for sure.
I feel like I'd already known that for a long time. Because I remember when I was obsessed with Led Zeppelin, she popped up in the Led Zeppelin story.
Okay.
As being kind of a contemporary who, you know, like I said, turned Jerry Wexler onto them. Right. Although I'm guessing because of how connected Jimmy Page was at the time too, being a session musician and working with like the Yardbirds and whatnot, like that he was connected as well. So maybe there's a little column A, column B, you know.
Sure.
You know, people helping each other out. But yeah, let's talk a little bit about her voice, because that's what she's doing here. She's singing. And it's, I don't know, like Naomi, you were saying that you found that it was the other songs on the album that sold her vocal performance for you. Is there like one in particular you can think of? Or
honestly, I thought all of them were better vocal performances than Son of a Preacher Man. But there wasn't one that really stood out. I would just say, of course, like the song that I liked the most, maybe because the intro song, because it just hit me like, whoa, who's this singer? This is not what I expected.
Yeah, I kind of have to agree, just because I was surprised, like, you know, it's not what I expected putting the album on in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking, okay, maybe I'll hear a little more in the vein of Son of a Preacher Man.
Sure.
But then that came on and it was like, oh. So it was a surprise overall. If I had any complaint about the production on this album, is that there's a couple of times where her vocal gets a little bit buried, you know, in the production overall.
Yeah. Right.
But as far as production goes, man, like this thing, I can't believe that it was like, you know, almost sometimes it sounds so seamless. It's hard to believe that it's like, all right, we got most of the rhythm tracks all taken care of in one location, ship these tapes to New York and then finish the sessions there. Like, they're so seamless, right?
Yeah.
And they're subtle. Like, it's good. It's good layered, subtly layered, like production too. I'm sure that whatever I'm listening to has got to be, I tried my best to avoid, there's a few, like, you know, deluxe editions out there and stuff. I tried my best to listen to the earliest, version that I could, but I'm guessing I'm hearing a little bit of remastering or whatever, but nonetheless, just paying attention to the production and whatnot, I'm like, this is pretty much the premium production you could get like in the 60s, you know?
Mm.
Like we've been talking, and we might even just do a whole episode about it, me and Charlie, I think, about Wichita Lineman quite a bit.
Yes.
And that's an example of the Wrecking Crew, which I don't, was not the musicians on this one, but with the Wrecking Crew, with like strings and lush arrangements on top of it. And man, I can listen to that one headphones on and I almost like, God, it's almost a psychedelic experience. You know, I Absolutely. Found that this got close, not quite there, but there's times where the backup singers are doing their things and there's these string arrangements in the background and it's, you know, but then you can hear the musicians up front really jamming. In fact, when they go to the bridge in Son of a Preacher Man, I think the bass player falls behind.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of an off. I don't know. It's weird. Thing. I think it's not quite out of key per se, but I think that like he's still on, you know, he's like on a fifth or something instead of the one, or like maybe a third or like, you know, maybe he's on, I don't know. It's weird. I have to listen to it again. It's not as egregious as, like, you know, I've listened to some of these songs. Like, I remember I'll bring this up sometimes, and, you know, the bass is ever so slightly out of tune on like the Rolling Stones Wild Horses.
Sure.
And you're like, man, that's something that only happened back then. You know, that would never, I mean, it would only happen on purpose now.
Right.
Now, not only can you overdub, but you can go and you can
pitch match and shit.
Pitch match. And, well, not just, like, you can pitch correct.
Pitch correct. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And everything, like, you know, you can just, if you want, you can cut and paste like from another take.
Right.
If you want. Right. This is like, this is still in the era of like, you're getting performances in the studio. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's a choice. But to my ear, I'm like, that bass player fell behind. He like they're all switching to the bridge and he was not ready for the bridge. He was looking at chart A,
yeah,
and they went to chart B.
That was the one time I wasn't paying attention, and that's the take you use.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But then they ship these tapes and then they go to New York and they're adding strings and stuff to, and it's just like, oh man, this whole era, like, I've, you know, of it's performances, it's real performances. Like, you can't pitch correct like anybody's voice. The best you could do at the time was maybe you could pull like a Chipmunks kind of thing where you speed up or slow down a vocal a little bit, mm-hmm. but you can only do it so much that it still falls in time with the music. Right. And mm-hmm. that's it. That's the closest thing they had. But if you go a little too far one way or the other, you're going to make them sound weird. Right. Like, you're making me either sound like the Chipmunks or the opposite. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a record out there where somebody was doing this thing on purpose. There probably was. But I guess anyway, this is the genius of a Jerry Wexler, right? You know, I would say like go listen to some of those Atlantic records from the 60s, some of the pop records, other pop records he was doing. You know, he made hits for Aretha Franklin, like we were talking mm-hmm. about before. Like, you know, where did Respect come from? It came from Jerry Wexler recording sessions. You know. Just amazing, great production, great song arrangements, that sort of thing. And he's also the guy who discovered songwriters like Carole King.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a credit on here.
More, a couple, yeah, actually, like three, four.
Carole King does?
Yeah, I think so.
I only see one, but doesn't mean that she was like a house writer for Jerry Wexler and Atlantic. So
the list I'm looking at, it says Carole King for the second song, and then it says King for like three other songs.
Okay, so
I'm assuming they just, you know what, we said her name. They said the name once in full. So now
totally, that could be right. But yeah, same, and everybody
knows Randy Newman.
How prolific Carole King went on to be, right? Sure. Like,
yeah.
She had her whole own career, like, well, even after this, like, she was making hits for everybody and then went on to have her own solo career. What after? Yeah. So I don't know. Like, I think this is definitely a little snapshot of a time and a place of a sound and like things that were happening at the time. And, yeah, and I think as a tome of history, I really appreciated some of that stuff about it. I just found that that overall, though, I found that as a whole album, I think in the end, it's a little lukewarm by the end of side two.
Right.
Yeah, like I wasn't drawn into Windmills of Your Mind as much as you were, but then again, I don't really have the history.
Well, it's not even the history so much as the thing that fascinates me most about it, because it was cool. It's like, oh yeah, it's this skit I remember as a kid, but also like listening to the lyrics, and they're so frantic and they're so like building that like it felt more contagious to listen to the lyrics than the rest of, like, in this song specifically, more than like anything else on the album for me. Like, I was like, what? And it gets a little, I mean, I guess it makes sense if it's like, if it's French stuff, but like, just it gets a little weird. And I was like, I am all here for this.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was a thing going on at the time. I don't what other examples are there of that era of music, of pop music, like Girl from Ipanema.
Okay. You know, yeah.
Stuff like that. People were throwing in like these little kind of little bossa nova grooves and stuff like that. I think it was a little bit of a holdover too from like the lounge era.
Hmm.
You know,
it's true. I do like, love some lounge.
Yeah, there's definitely a, like a little element of that. There's a cosmopolitan element to this that doesn't necessarily sell the Dusty and Memphis thing, right? Like it doesn't all sound like Memphis. Some of it sounds a lot like New York. I would say for sure. It's a maybe. I don't know. I don't even know if it's 50-50.
Well, okay, but now I understand what brings it a little bit more weight of calling it Dusty and Memphis, because honestly, at the beginning, I guess I just didn't think about the fact that she was English, you know? Like I would have thought, yeah, she's just from the States or whatever, right? Like I didn't put that together. So that definitely adds to the like we brought her all the way over here to do some sessions is a little bit more of a big deal than just you know, well, we went down, popped down to the studio, right?
Yeah.
We're adding a bit of a new flavor to
yeah, what for
she's
sure.
already doing.
I mean, does it discredit her at all? Like the fact that she is a foreigner?
No, not at all. It's if anything, it shows how strong she is because it sounds seamless, so seamless, right? So you're like, yeah, I just believe that this is the way she sounds. That's completely makes sense.
Yeah. I wonder if it ever confused her audiences. Do you think that there was people who got sold on something like Son of a Preacher Man and then came to a Dusty Springfield concert expecting more of that and then got... you know, the windmills of your mind.
And we're like, well, then they didn't do their homework. Did
let me tell you, about a little band called Sugar Ray. Okay.
Oh, God. All right. You're going to compare Dusty Springfield to Sugar Ray.
Well, that's the first thing that pops into my head is how a lot of people came to the party for Fly. And that's the only song that sounds like Fly on that album is what I mean.
Man, I mean, talk about that. What about that Mean Machine stuff?
That's right. That's right.
Like, who is that?
Okay. For sure.
That's all I'm saying is like, you know, you it is a fish out of water in that regard where it's a different sound.
Okay, but here's the thing is, then they followed that record up with a record where every song sounded like Fly.
They absolutely just jumped right in. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Every morning there's a halo hanging on the corner of my girl's
four-post bed. 1459.
I just want to fly. Anyway, I would say the difference here is that have a hit with like Look of Love and then don't make an album of Look of Love.
Right.
Make an album with Son of a Preacher Man. And then Son of a Preacher Man pops out and is the hit.
Sure.
You know, so I'm not super familiar with like the trajectory of Dusty Springfield's career. I feel like she struggled to be relevant much after, I don't know, like, I don't know if she blew up and went on to have a giant career. I don't think so.
I don't think she did. I think this was like maybe her sixth album in or something like that. Like she was a bunch of albums in.
This is its fifth album.
Yeah. Fifth album in. And like, she didn't have too many more after, I don't believe, that were like huge, that were big on the charts and whatnot.
Well, like this is one. Still in that bigger. Era of putting out like almost two albums a year.
Hmm.
For most artists, most major signed recording artists. So I think she got a handful more out, but.
Oh, she got a bunch more out, I suppose. But I feel like from what I know, I would think that this would be the more of the peaking of the career part. And then after that, it was just like, she was still putting out albums, but.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder. You say, Naomi, you said you were looking at like a list of hit songs. Did she follow this up with any more hit songs?
I don't know the time trajectory of it. That's the thing. I just saw based on her wiki.
Yeah.
Some of the titles of the songs and I went, oh, I know that. I know that. I'd like to just take a look here and see. The list of her albums.
Research. Yeah.
Yeah, she struggled to stay relevant. Was she kind of overshadowed by the end of the 60s and into the 70s by like the different trends, you know? Like, I just have a hard time seeing her staying relevant, but you know, like, which is a shame if that's true.
I mean, she had her own TV series, but that was in the late 60s.
Well, around the time that she was blown up.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm just looking through the later releases to see if I recognize anything, but nothing so far.
Nothing's popping up, hey?
Not yet.
Yeah. Well,
she did release a lot, though.
That's more than I was expecting. I looked at the list, too, and she definitely released more than I was expecting. Maybe this would be about halfway through her.
She covered Tupelo Honey by Van Morrison. That's a cover. Has to be a cover.
Well, okay. Well, and then she passed away fairly young at like
58 or 60 or something like that.
Yeah. Breast cancer. I don't think
she made it to her 60s, which is too bad. I remember she went undiagnosed with breast cancer for quite a while.
Hmm.
So she passed away within like a few years of her diagnosis. Which is tragic, which is a shame, of course. Yeah. Now, okay. Does anybody, what of her songs did the Pet Shop Boys do? Did she work with the Pet Shop Boys? Because for some reason, when you Googled Dusty Springfield, the Pet Shop Boys pop up.
Yeah. A related artist, because she did do a collaboration with them. I think in the 80s, late 80s.
Oh,
I think it's an original song.
Really? I am, man, I'm completely ignorant to this. I have one Pet Shop Boys record in my album collection, and I never listened to it. I should really throw it on, though. I feel like one of these days I'll have a party or something, and it'll be relevant, you know? It's just nothing that I ever put on it at home, but, man, like, is it like that Tammy Wynette thing with...
That thing's the best. With the KLF, Justified and Ancients.
Yeah.
So good. Moo Moo Land.
Yeah. Is it something like that where it's like late in her career, just desperately trying to be relevant? And, you know, like,
this, I haven't listened to it.
Oh, what song
is she?
This shows you that we're not doing a ton of research. That we're mostly listening to an album.
No, this is like off the cuff opinion. It was 1987 and it was pretty much. Well, what did do good song? It did well. The song was called "What Have I Done to Deserve This?" Got her back at the top of the charts for the first time in a very, very long time.
Hmm.
Number two in the UK singles chart.
Is it a duet?
Yep.
Okay. See, here's the thing: is the reason I'm asking all these questions, though, is because after listening to this, I'm like, oh, I can't believe I've been sleeping on Dusty Springfield this whole time. Like, she must have done more, right? Like. Is there not a Dusty Springfield's greatest hits album or something that just sold super well? Like, I feel like even from this album alone, you could put three of those songs on there, put the Look of Love, put a couple more deep cuts that are pretty good. And like, you'd have a pretty solid record. Like, as talented as she was and as good as some of these songs are and some of the other ones that I've heard, I don't know about the albums themselves. There's got to be more out there, right?
I mean, I think that maybe sort of what I was saying is right where this was, where she peaked musically. She still put out a whole bunch of albums, but I don't know how much they charted or anything like that. But I mean, from what the little bit I read earlier, and I was mentioning about her, like, having stage fright, and like, it seems like she had a whole bunch of things that didn't quite, you know, that were like near misses, or things that like, this would have worked out, but, you know, this happened, or, you know, like, she just had some things not quite work out to the unfortunate point where she didn't click with the public maybe as much as
Or maybe it was a little like a lack of focus in a direction or something. Like, this album is, you know, we're appreciating it, but you maybe audiences at the time weren't appreciating it as much.
Well, that's just it. They didn't, because it didn't sell well, right?
Well, yeah, you're right. It didn't. Exactly. You know, so yeah, I feel like, you know, this is almost worthy of like one hit wonder status, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is a shame. But
see if I can bring it up real quick again. But I was looking briefly at her discography, and it was mentioning things like where the albums peaked when they came out, if I can get back to that part. But it didn't seem like they peaked very high, you know, like a lot of them were like just made the top 100 when they peaked.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that right there shows that, like, you know, Let's see, Dusty in Memphis, peak chart position number 99 in the U.S. And the next one peaked at number 107 in the U.S. and number 35 in the U.K. So, like, good in the U.K., you know, where the bread, where her bread and butter was, I suppose. But, like, not a lot of, I guess, universal reach.
Yeah, yeah, I'm looking around too, and I'm like, oh, even on the next album, the best she charted was 24, which, I mean, nothing to sneeze at per se, but that's, you know, that's.
And then it looks like there's a couple of albums after that throughout the 70s that just, like, didn't really chart at all.
Yeah, well, I gotta imagine going into the 70s, this flavor was, you know, this was no longer the soup du jour. This is
that sounds delicious,
which is a shame. Like, there's, I don't know. I feel like I wish that maybe she had leaned into one or the other, leaned into the pop nouveau, or lean into the, you know, Southern soul. Maybe end up doing a little country funk. Maybe hanging out with guys like Donnie Fritz a little more.
Yeah, but that's your answer for everything right now.
It is.
Should have done some country funk.
I'm just saying, because it's cool as fuck, right? Because here's the thing. So right after I listened to this record, I immediately went and listened to a bunch of Bobby Gentry.
Mm-hmm.
And how good is Bobby Gentry?
Well, that's funny that you mentioned that, because I kind of did the reverse. I've been listening to some Bobby Gentry, like, quite a bit lately, and then moved into this album. And I was like, I mean, this sounds right at home with, you know?
Yeah. Well, and then, of course, right off the bat, like, I just went to Spotify. And after this, you know, just was like, yeah, Bobby Gentry, just hit play. And right off the top, like, you know, Ode to Billy Joe, Fancy, right? Like, then what comes on, I think number three, number four, her version of Son of a Preacher Man. I'm like, oh, this is fucking, this is all so good. This is all just killer shit, man. It's so good.
Yeah.
You know, like, the least funky thing that Bobby Gentry did was that album with Glenn Campbell, right? Where they did a duet version of Gentle on My Mind.
Yeah.
But then, goddamn, Glenn Campbell was so good and so smooth. He was like the pop contemporary version of, like, you know, country music at the time. He was one of those crossover artists, as they called them. Whatever. You know, it was just, but you know what? It was fun. It was just like, I already liked Gentle on My Mind. And now here's Bobby Gentry singing a few verses of it. Cool. Anyway. Yeah. So I would say Dusty Springfield, if you're digging Dusty in Memphis and the songs you're leaning to are, you know, the country soul songs, you probably dig a little bit of Bobby Gentry if you haven't listened to much Bobby Gentry.
I think if you enjoy this album, I think it's you, there's a good chance you might like some Bobby Gentry for sure.
Yeah. I'm just there were so many similarities to them, except the difference is that Bobby Gentry just sells that Southern, you know, I don't even know if Bobby Gentry is from the South.
it's more legit in the fact that she is from the States, though. Like, she was American. Legit from there. Like,
yeah. I mean, and she was the original badass. Like, I don't want to turn this into a Bobby Gentry.
I was going to say, thank you for listening to our Bobby Gentry podcast.
Were we just fanboy over Bobby Gentry? oh, yeah. She was born in the Mississippi, Woodland, Mississippi. That so, okay. Sense. She's legit. So she sells it. But listen, if you think Reba McEntire wrote Fancy, you're wrong.
Or we got podcast for you.
Yeah, you got a history lesson coming, son. You get anyways, Bobby Gentry to listen
for now. But for now,
we're listening to Dusty Springfield.
We're still listening to Dusty. Which, you know what? And I got to mention, this is great. I love that this showed up on the list, because, like, a handful of times when I'll be record shopping, I will see this in the bin and I'll just be like, I wonder, you know, like, it doesn't fit what I'm buying right now, and I don't got the extra cash, but I've been curious about it for quite a while. So it was cool to see it come up on the list and be like, hey, cool, I get to listen to this one, right?
Okay. Well, I don't know. In fear of going out of order, maybe hold on to that thought for a minute, but do you guys want to know what the Rolling Stone had to say about it?
What they got to say?
Yeah, yabba dabba do. Okay, Rolling Stone. Oh, I lost it. Whoops. I was looking through some tabs. Talk amongst yourselves.
Silence.
Do you Do you want me to read from the OG copy, the 2012 copy?
No, I got it
copy?
Right here. Okay. It'll take me 2 seconds. Yeah, silence.
I'm going to follow along anyways.
Music's original alternative. Okay, so coming in at number 83 on Rolling Stone's Greatest Albums of All Time list is Dusty Springfield's Dusty in Memphis. They said, born in London, Dusty Springfield was a great soul singer. Hidden inside a white British pop queen, racking up Motown-style hits such as I Only Want to Be With You, when Atlantic producer Jerry Wexler brought her way down south to Memphis to make this album. She was so intimidated by the idea of recording with session guys from her favorite Aretha Franklin and Otis Redding hits that she never actually managed to sing a note there. Interesting. Okay. Her vocals were overdubbed later when the sessions moved to New York, but the result was blazing soul and sexual honesty. Breakfast in Bed, Son of a Preacher Man, they put those in quotes, that transcend both race and geography.
That's so funny. So that is word for word, basically what is in the 2012 version, except for the phrasing of she was so intimidated by the idea of recording with session guys from her favorite Aretha Franklin and Wilson Pickett hits.
Oh, I wonder why it was amended.
They amended they were like, actually that wasn't, it wasn't Wilson Pickett. It was it.
Like, oh, they proofread it. And they're like, well, let's, you know, this thing is, we'll stick to music, but Rolling Stone these days is doing such a bad job of like vetting their sources in recent news, like headlines and stuff like that, that I'm glad to see somebody fact check something at some point for Rolling Stone and didn't just go to Twitter to verify.
So you're saying, so that's number 83. We're doing number 83, but back in 2012, it was down at number 89. So it's moved
up
a little bit.
That's not a big move.
Not a big move.
That's very close. It's in the same realm. That's
just
in the
one
same...
page over in the book, really.
Huh. Interesting.
And, I think it's a bit of a flipperoo because previously at number 83 was Axis Bold as Love.
Oh, okay.
So I think they just kind of switched over, didn't they? Pretty close anyways, because we did Axis, right?
Axis is at 92.
Oh, okay. So that fell a little bit more.
Yeah, but they're both very close.
It's fun to see them kind of like, you know, they just kind of like jumped around a little bit.
Shifted a little, yeah, but not a big difference. Okay, yeah. Well, interesting, interesting. Oh, what do you guys think, though? Does it deserve its ranking? Should it be number 83?
Yeah, I think so. I think that what's important, too, is what she did for other British females, because there was a path that was paved there.
Hmm.
You know, I think because of her, that's why we have someone like Adele now.
Well, yeah. You know, I'm surprised we didn't bring that up earlier, right. But I had thought about this yesterday and I just didn't make a note about it. But I'm like, yeah, Adele is kind of her legacy, right? You know, like, I mean, the comparisons, they're British. They're both pop singers who inject soul elements, like the genre of soul into their work.
Yeah, there's definitely some similarities in the career path and such there, I believe so.
Yeah, I would say that Adele dwells more in the realm of ballads. But I don't know.
Not necessarily the genre, but just the path seems.
I've never sat down and listened to an Adele record through, so I only know the singles. I only know her James Bond theme song, Skyfall, which is peak Adele. Right. Okay. Actually, I was thinking that listening to this album, now that I think about it, that's where I got the Adele thing from. Now, which song is it? Is it the Windmills of Reminder? One of them that I was like, it was one of the French influence, like the French pop, like Nouveau.
That makes sense. That would make sense.
I was like, this is very James Bond theme song.
Yeah.
Like if it was more specific in the theme song about like, you know, like if it's like in the windmills of your mind or something like that, like just one of those big takes on a lyric, I would have been like, this is a fucking James Bond song. But it was
close. That for sure. Yeah, it's a James Bond movie where the final big fight is in a windmill. Yeah, it's real real badass.
Yeah, or like it has something to do with Man of La Mancha or something, you know, Don Quixote.
Quixote for sure. Yeah.
And is there a James Bond movie where there's a Don Quixote motif?
There's got to be. No, is there isn't. James but there Bond should
really
there,
a Don Quixote motif?
Yeah, that's right. That's a different podcast too. Damn it.
That's our literary podcast.
That's learning to read.
The windmills, tilting at the windmills.
We have a spinoff.
Learning to read.
Okay. Naomi, you said, yeah, Charlie, where are you at?
I also think that it's deserving of its rank.
It deserves number 83.
Actually, you know what? Honestly, I would switch it back to where it was before, a little bit lower. What did I say? 89. Bump it back down to 89. I think it was better there. Switch it places with the Axis. Bold as
okay,
love.
Okay, fair enough.
But still in the top 100 for sure.
Oh, no. My recording was stopped.
That's all right. I still got you.
Okay, cool. I'm not sure why I got stopped.
How did that happen?
I don't know. Something about disk space, but it should have more than enough. So we'll see. Anyway, back to the episode. Okay, well, I'm not sure myself.
Okay.
I'm not convinced. Here's the thing. I think this album and Dusty probably do deserve to be recognized, represented in some way. Maybe this is her best album. So maybe this is the album that deserves to be on here. I'm just in the top 100. I'm not 100% sure.
You're not now, top 100.
Son of a Preacher Man, that song alone, though. So maybe because the album has that song, that's enough to justify it being here.
I would also think that it would have to do with the fact that I don't know how much people were coming over from the UK to record in like Memphis before, were they?
I don't know. I don't know.
Because I would think that would be, you know, that would pull some of the weight as
well,
to
at
why.
This point,
you're like,
the
well,
Stones
this is a pretty cool thing, right?
At this point, the Stones had been in Alabama at Muscle Shoals. I'm sure that they made a pit stop over to check out, you know, the legend of rock and roll and stuff. And I don't know if they ever recorded in Memphis, though. Mm. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, maybe it was unique.
Go to Memphis. Never mind.
You know, but there's a lot of songs about Memphis. A lot of British people have sang about Memphis or covered people from Memphis. Like,
I wrote a song about Memphis.
Yeah, that Naomi wrote a song about Memphis, so.
And she's gonna sing it for us right now.
I just did. It's over now. Go to YouTube.
Yeah. So you know, Memphis is I guess, yeah, in a weird, in a way, Memphis is a kind of a mecca, right? A cultural hub for music. Sun Records, you know, what, like, didn't B.B. King come out of Memphis? A lot of people, a lot of blues, a lot of Delta blues came out of that area.
For sure.
Yeah. Memphis, Tennessee, son. Okay, well, here's the real question, though. Is it going in your record collection? Charlie, I believe you said yes.
I said yes. I said before, I mean, what I was saying was just that I'd seen it before and it piqued my interest. I haven't, but I would put it in there, but I was very happy to have this chance to check it out because I've been meaning to for quite some time. So
preview it before. Yeah.
But now that I've previewed it, yeah, I'm into it.
I feel like this pops up quite frequently in like the $5 bins and stuff too. So
yeah, I've definitely seen it around and it does make for a pretty good, like Sunday kind of chilling album.
For sure.
I think.
Oh yeah, totally. Oh yeah. Right. Put this on and then, you know, hop back in the sack with the old lady. Like, yeah. That's what she's singing about. We got
breakfast in bed.
Naomi, what about you?
Yeah, actually, yeah. And I don't do that very often. Oh, I'll listen to it again.
Yeah, this is your third one.
Oh, great.
That's funny. I've been thinking of, like, there's those memes where you see someone pointing at a completely empty shelf in a supermarket or something. I'm going to do it and turn it into an L2L meme that's like,
yeah,
Naomi's record collection.
Yeah.
Just a barren shelf.
It's an empty shelf. And you're just very, you know, particular, right?
Yeah.
And that's okay.
I might be the one that flips the script this time and say, nah.
Oh, you're a miss.
Well, only because it's just not. It goes lukewarm on me in too many spots.
Okay.
There's some solid stuff on this record. And, I think. This is one I think I would come back around to after maybe I was like, I'm going to grab the greatest hits record first. Listen to a few more tunes on there, get a little more familiar with the catalog. And then once I've gotten that one, I'll be like, all right, maybe I should get the OG. Maybe I should get the real deal.
Right.
You know, deep cuts and all. But look, that's not an endorsement of the album. It's definitely a solid record. Solid performance. Dusty was great. Just it's missing a couple of tracks for me. It's just missing something.
He needs more spice.
Less pop nouveau and
more country funk, damn it.
Exactly. More country funk. More Donnie Fritz. Okay. well, okay, so there we go. We all know what we're adding to our collection. So guys, thanks for listening. Thanks for hanging out with us today. If you want to know what we're going to be doing and talking about, or if you want to follow along at home, of course, you can always check out our social medias. You know, we got all of the stuff, but if you want a quick and easy place to find them all, we've got one of those websites. Charlie, what's that website?
Oh, I'll tell you, it's l2lpodcast.com.
Right on. And hey, we finally managed to get a few phone calls. So what are your thoughts on Dusty Springfield? Like, I mean, did you follow her career? Is Dusty in Memphis one of the greatest albums of all time? Or is it just the best one in her career? Or does she have better records? Why don't you let us know? Call us and tell us. And hey, you never know. You might hear your voicemail on this show at some point. Naomi, what's that number they can call?
They can call us at 780-851-8785.
Right on, right on, right on. And of course, my co-hosts are fully realized people with their own ambitions in life, and they got their own things going on. And why don't you guys tell them about them? Charlie, what do you got to plug?
That's right, Quinn. I'm not just a character. You can come down and find me at oldmandesign.com, where you can get all kinds of fun t-shirts like this one I'm wearing right now. It says Chonk 316. It's just like, you know, you should go get it. Just come down to oldmandesign.com. We'll get you sorted.
Right on. Okay. That's a very inside joke for people to want to buy it. But if you're a fan of the Chonk, then make sure you go get a Chonk t-shirt. Naomi, what do you got going on?
I'm also hosting another podcast called Dope Nostalgia, where we talk about people from the 90s. And my guest this week will be a singer from Sweden by the name of Keo, who's a vocalist in two techno dance groups at the time. She was part of La Clique and La Bouche.
Right on, right on, right on. Okay. And then, of course, you can go to our Patreon, patreon.com/learningtolisten. If you want some bonus content, we got it there for you. Or if you just want to help us out, man. Help us out.
I might need
throw us a few dollars. You know, things are tight. Things are lean. It's been COVID for a long time. But if you got it, if you don't, hey, just spread the word. Tell people about the podcast. You know, share it with your friends. But if you can help us out, patreon.com/learningtolisten. We promise that there's extra content up there for you. All right. But thank you so much for hanging out with us and listening and, you know, subscribing, liking, sharing, all that sort of stuff. We really appreciate it. What are we going to be doing next week, you guys? What are we doing
next week?
It's going to be Sly and the Family Stone. There's a riot going on.
Oh, yeah. Shit.
Number 82 on Rolling Stone's greatest albums of all time list. So that's going to be a fun listen.
I think. I've been taking a peek ahead here to see the next few albums coming up, and some of them are quite exciting.
Excited.
Ooh, we're getting, you know, it's getting somewhere. It's going somewhere. I feel like it's going to go down to number one at some point. All right. So anyway, that's what we're doing next week. There's a riot going on.
Yeah. By the time I'm 50, we're going to hit number one. Can't wait.
Hey, at least you get something to do in your old age. Okay.
That's true.
So, guys, if you're down in Memphis and you're eating barbecue out on some patio and it gets dusty in Memphis, you gotta wrap it up.
You're so proud of yourself. You get that little look on your face like... The music was fun,
yeah.
And then it got really dark for a while, a little bit anti-establishment.
But the next thing you knew, it was totally fun again.
So many artists came and went,
and left us wondering, what are they doing now? This podcast isn't about the heavy hitters who are still making millions. It's about everyone else, the ones whose careers didn't really leave that decade and kind of just still live in our memory.
So you mean Vanilla Ice had another song?
We all know what happened to Marky Mark, but what about the Funky Bunch? Who were the KLF? And why did Tammy Wynette record a song with an electro dance band that topped the charts? Two genres that specifically defined the 90s. What were freestyle and New Jack Swing all about? Did you know that Blossom star Joey Lawrence had a huge pop hit? Or that Alanis Morissette had a really hot pop career in Canada before Jagged Little Pill? Special guests will also be joining me to discuss the great era of glitter, grunge, thin eyebrows, hammer pants, and total ridiculousness. We're even setting up some interviews with some of the musicians that define the times.
Okay, so if you're older than 30, you might be sitting here going, man, I totally remember that song, but I have no idea who does that. Well, then you better listen and find out.
I'm Naomi Carmack, host of the Ultimate 90s podcast, Dope Nostalgia. You're going to be busting the move again, coming in early 2020. You want to follow us so that you know when we go live? Check out our Twitter at NostalgiaDope, or you can find us on Instagram at Dope_Nostalgia. If you've got a question or you just want to be on the show, email us at DopeNostalgiaPodcast@gmail.com.